Hi, everybody. This is That's Criminal with John Stamp. Really excited today to be talking with Mr. Carl De Niro. Mr. De Niro has written a book called The Son of Sam and Me, The Truth About Why I Wasn't Shot by David Berkowitz. Now, as we get into it, very quickly, I'm going to go over Mr. Berkowitz. I'll touch on him real quick. Many people know David Berkowitz as the self-proclaimed son of Sam. During 1976, 1977, Mr. Berkowitz killed six victims, wounded seven, was captured in 1977 and arrested and indicted, August of 77. Currently serving six life sentences. Mr. De Niro, on the night of October 23rd, 1976, him and Miss Rosemary Keenan left a local bar in Flushing, Queens. Short drive to a nearby park, sitting in their car, when suddenly gunfire shattered all the windows of the Volkswagen Beetle they're sitting in. Bullets missed Miss Keenan completely. Mr. De Niro and she fled, returned back to the bar, where at that time Mr. De Niro reported to his friends that he suddenly wasn't feeling all that hot and collapsed in the bar right there. So what we're hoping to talk to Mr. De Niro about today is that relationship and how that's affected and the work that's come out of that incident so many years ago. So Mr. De Niro, I appreciate you taking the time to meet me.
Thanks for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be on your show. You pretty much nailed the story. I know the shooting itself was, although it was traumatic, physically traumatic, the story really doesn't start for a couple of years later. It was just kind of like it started out. You have to realize I was the second victim, so there was no son of Sam when I was shot. So it was, to be honest with you, the cops, the two detectives on my case, one was Rosemary's dad, Red Keenan. He was, as you can imagine, not thrilled that his daughter was involved in a shooting, hanging out with a long-haired hippie like myself. Being they had nothing else to go on, the original thought was it was a drug deal gone bad. And back then I was a little pissed off that they would even think that, but as I got older and realized that and I became a dad myself, I realized what this guy went through, and I certainly cut him a lot of slack. But for the first 6 months, I was basically had to defend myself. Besides dealing with the head injuries that I sustained, I had to deal with the cops and my mother thinking it was a drug deal.
Ouch. Yeah. Now, as yeah. I understand it, the wound left you with some lingering effects. And you had to get part of your skull replaced. Is that correct?
That is true. Like I said, I got shot in October of 76 due to infections and what have you. I was in the hospital for 3 weeks. They sent me home. At the time, I was 20 years old, living with my mother, and I spent the next 2 months basically being a prisoner in my mother's house. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but I wasn't able to go out. So I basically just sat and read books and watched TV and stared out the window, trying to figure out, what the heck happened. I went in the hospital on January 20th, 77 to get a metal plate put in the back of my head to replace the part of the skull that was blown away.
Yes. That kind of recovery. And all the while, you're also I imagine having to defend yourself against Rosemary's dad, who, I mean, she can't, the guy shows up on scene and his daughter's, you know, been in a car that's been shot multiple times. You just started out as it didn't matter what the circumstances, you were with his little girl when this went down.
So I was in enemy. You're right. I was in a bad situation no matter what.
You weren't gonna win that one.
No.
And as I understand it, you had sworn in to the Air Force like a month beforehand, or two months beforehand.
Yeah, August. I got sworn in. Basically, I mean, let me step back a little bit. I attended college for two semesters, and school just wasn't for me. I'm fairly intelligent, but sitting in a classroom is not my thing. And I dropped out after two semesters. So that brings us to 75. And I just had a series of, like factory jobs. And I realized that this is, I got to do something something with my life besides working in a factory. So I decided to join the Air Force. At the time I was into photography, and I thought that would be pretty good. I get some training from the Air Force and, kind of give me some direction in life. And so I signed up. I scored well on the test. And I'm assuming because I scored well, I'm not positive of this, but in either case, they gave me what they called deferred enlistment. So I got sworn in August, and my report date was October 28th. And as you mentioned earlier, I was shot on the 23rd. So that quickly ended my Air Force career. I wound up getting an honorable discharge a couple days later. My mother called them and said, he's not showing up for basic training. And a week or two, I'm not even sure when, but a few weeks later, I received an honorable discharge.
Wow. Yep. And you're still in recovery at this time. It was just a matter of, just not able. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you for trying, right? You got there. You got sworn in and it all got taken away from you.
Yeah. My joke's like the friend around saying, my friends like to joke around saying, he's the only guy that went into the service and got shot before he went into the service. That's my claim to fame.
and I imagine that humor and I might be leaping ahead here a little bit, but as you said, you were the second victim of Berkowitz and or co-conspirators, and we'll get into that in a minute. But at the time, it's a shooting in New York City, so you have to defend yourself against the presuppositions that came at you. But then you had a period of time where you were shot in New York City. The case goes. But none of this Mr. Berkowitz issue was a thing there was a span of time where did it all just come crashing at you once they finally stood up a task force and recognized something, or how did it?
Yeah. So the timeline was, basically I'm shot wrong place, wrong time. There was no fanfare. I don't even think there was the major newspapers in New York didn't even cover it because, for those of you old enough to remember, New York City in 76 was a dangerous time. There was a lot of shootings, a lot of muggings. The Bronx is burning. It was not a good time for New York City. But with that said, I grew up in a fairly affluent neighborhood in North Flushing, which is where I got shot. And all that stuff that you read about was foreign to me and foreign to my neighborhood. We didn't have shootings. Buildings weren't being burnt down. Like I said, it was a fairly good neighborhood. So I just chalked it up. I think the police might have looked at it differently because, you know, they look at the big picture, and, you know, there's riots and, you know, fires and shootings in Brooklyn, Manhattan, Bronx, and even parts of Queens, but not my section. So, you know, I guess the leap to being a drug dealer gone awry isn't that much of a leap, you know, for the police to take, you know. So for the next 6 months, I basically lived that way. It was just wrong place, wrong time. And then March 10th of 77, the mayor, Mayor Beam, and Police Commissioner Codd held a press conference. Now, this is right after, the day after the fifth shooting. And that's when they were able to put together a case for a serial killer. Although they said that it came from the same gun, they really didn't know it came from the same gun. But what they were sure about, it was a high caliber, a high caliber bullet. They were able to ascertain on it, I believe, four of the cases that it was definitely a 44. One case they said it might be a 45, I'm not a ballistics guy, but what I've learned since then is that's not a typical bullet that the average criminal uses. They usually use like a 38, which obviously is smaller than a 44. So March 10th was the date that, like I said, I like to call it Vindication Day, because that was the date that I could tell my mother and the cops and anyone else who thought I was involved in a drug deal, I told you it wasn't a drug deal. It was, you know, wrong place, wrong time. But so it was vindication on that front, but it also opened up a whole new can of worms for me. You know, who shot me? Why? You know, all the questions you would think would be brought up involving a serial killer. You know, like, was I stalked? You know, was I targeted? Was I just random? I've been asking these questions for 45 years. I still don't have a definitive answer, believe it or not, but I'm still trying.
Yeah. Yeah. It could still be just wrong place, wrong time. It just happened to be him, you know. It's because I don't know if they ever went into his stalking tactics and all that. And it seems like with some of the things he said over the years, he wasn't exactly the most trustworthy, you know, not exactly the most remorseful, or, you know, not somebody who's going to write the factual tale of his without a bit of grandeur attached to it, like most of them. So it was, it seems like in that date in March, it was oddly cathartic. And then at the same time, you're starting all over again. Just, yeah, wondering exactly why me, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. So was there any pressure that came with that once that came out? Like, were the media on you, or were the police on you even further? Or was it like, hey, guess what? You came within contact with the Son of Sam, and now we're moving on. You know,
it's more like the latter. You know, a lot of people are asked me this question about, you know, how did I keep up with the case? And my pat answer is the truth. And that is, I kept up with the case like everyone else in New York. I read the papers every day. I had very little interaction. I, you know, a couple after the initial detectives visiting me in the hospital the day after I got shot, I had very little contact with the police. They did send me at one point, they came to my house and, you know, gave me a list of suspects. Basically, it was just a list of people who had been arrested in the 109th precinct. And they asked me if I knew anyone. And I'm looking at the list and I knew a lot of them, but they were all, yeah, exactly. But it's not as bad as it sounds. The names that I knew, it was guys that got arrested for stealing a bike. I think one guy did steal a car, a couple guys, you know, for public intoxication, you know, possession of marijuana, nothing major. And I said that, you know, there's no one in my life there's a few people who might want to smack me around, but no one dislikes me that much to shoot me.
So
that was probably, I don't know, maybe November of 76, 2 months, a month or two after I got shot. Even when they had the press conference and they announced it as the serial killer, I didn't get a follow-up phone call from anyone saying, all right, you know, you're off the hook, or I apologize, or whatever. So that was it. And I just followed the case in the newspapers, for another, you know, well, I guess about a year after they arrested David Berkowitz. Then I had done a few interviews during this period. Actually, I did a few interviews before they even caught the Berkowitz. And to be quite honest with you, I'm 20 years old. It was kind of cool to see a picture in the, you know, the front page of the local paper and, the 6 o'clock news. But I have to say, in 1978, it got a little bit too hairy for me. Wherever I went, you know, people were like whispering, you know, I'd walk into a bar and people were whispering, that's the guy that got shot by Son of Sam. And I kind of felt like my identity was being taken away. I was always very outgoing, had a ton of friends. I could walk into probably 50 different bars and know people there. Not that I'm an alcoholic. I just like the social aspect of it.
Oh yeah.
But it got to the point where it was like, this is just too much for me. So I packed up my bags. At this point, I had a job, an apartment. I gave that all up and moved out to California. And I stayed there for 2 years. And really just to get away from the Son of Sam hysteria. I came back in the spring of 80. And it was perfect timing, because every now and then Son of Sam would come up, but it wasn't on everyone's, you know, everyone's lips, you know.
Yeah. And that was my next question, is if it got to the point you just had to cut and make that decision that this is not me, I'm making myself here. Right. And it seems like when you told me, you know, your professional background and how you've made your life for yourself, it seems like you just was like, no, I'm not going to be put into this category. I'm going to make my own life. And yeah, so you just up and moved and let it blow over.
Yeah. That was the move was a big move, because, I have family and friends here, and I still live in New York. I like New York. Moving to, especially, at this point, I guess I'm 21, moving across the country I did have two friends out there, so I wasn't all alone. But it was a big move. And I realized in retrospect that was the beginning of basically my healing process and slowly transforming myself from a victim to a survivor. And I didn't even realize the survivor part of it until probably, I don't know, 7 or 8, 9 years ago, very late in life. I realized, I think someone mentioned it to me. It's like, you're not a victim, you're a survivor. And I thought about it and I said, you know, you're right. And because I've never let, even though I've stayed interested in the case and I've continued to research and, do other things to try to get answers from the case, I didn't let it affect my life. I got married. I had a good career in at a brokerage house. I'm in a telecom finance auditor. I've been doing that for 32 years. Raised my daughter, and I've had a very good life.
Yeah, and I always very careful with that term victim versus survivor. And you might've noticed I stumbled, when I was doing the intro saying that you are, you came in contact with, or you were shot by David Berkowitz. But I really, there's a distinction between that. You're a person's a victim at the time, mm-hmm. but they survived. The moment they survived that, you start taking those steps forward, you're a survivor. And I don't ever want to take it away from somebody, because that's, more often than not, a whole lot of work that people never really give focus or credit to. especially I would imagine in the late 70s, early 80s, there was not such things as critical incident stress. There was not such things as, you know, having the available therapy and facilities for people to visit to get that help to take those steps. So I imagine.
Yes. Yeah, you're 100% correct. And don't feel bad for stumbling over it because, you know, like I said, it took me, unbeknownst to me, I was a survivor and didn't even realize it until someone pointed out to me. And the more I thought about it, the more I said, you know, I am, because there are victims of similar situations, even within this Son of Sam case, that I really hate to say it, but I think some of the people that were shot and survived are still victims. They just have not been able to move on with their life, and it's a shame. I feel bad for them, and on the other hand, I feel very lucky that I guess, like I said, I don't take personal credit for this. I think it's just part of my DNA and my, you know, I've always been an outgoing, I'd like to think I'm funny. Not everyone agrees with that, but, you know, but I'm always quick with the joke and, you know, it's kind of like the bar cheers, you know, when Norm walks in, that's the kind of greeting I get when I walk into a bar, you know, hey, Carl's here, you know, and, right. Yeah. So like I said, I guess I really can't take credit for it, but, I guess, I don't know, it was a good tool that, that God gave me to handle this.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially in what 21-year-old and, you know, 2 years out seeing all this fanfare says, nah, I gotta move forward. You know, and that's sounds like it was an instinctual thing. It was just like, I can't be labeled as this. I gotta make myself, which is, that's a strong move for anybody at any time trying to recover from something. I wanted to make a point of a distinction of that, you know? So I apologize for the stumble.
That's all right.
Like you said, you had a long and distinguished career in finance and in telecoms. The theory of the basis of your book, why I wasn't shot by David Berkowitz. You mentioned earlier, Maury Terry, who started that, Berkowitz, you know, in the 90s, he did make statements that said he was part of a cult and that he wasn't the only one pulling the trigger. But like we talked about, it's not like we could take anything that guy says as gospel. But your work investigating that theory, do you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Sure. So, like I said, obviously there was no internet no Google. There was really nothing for me to do. Wrong place, wrong time. Let's move on. And then in 1980, I had a civil case. Myself and all the victims filed a lawsuit. Just in case Berkowitz made any money, we would get our share. And at that hearing, one of the lawyers kept saying other people were involved. And I turned to my lawyer and asked, you know, what is he talking about? And he said, Harry Lipsig, he thinks other people were involved. And I'm like, wow, that's fascinating. And it really, I think there might've been a couple articles in the paper that touched on it, but I'll be honest with you, I really didn't take it that serious. And then in 1987, a book comes out called The Ultimate Evil, written by the late Maury Terry. And I devoured this book in 650 pages, and I devoured it I started reading it Friday night and I finished Saturday afternoon. And it was like, that was my introduction to other people were involved. And so that's like, you know, it was like mind blowing, but there was no place to go with it. You know, I couldn't even really talk about it to my friends. One friend read the book and I was able to talk to him about it, but other people looked at me like I was nuts. I get it. So you know, fast forward to 1990, and I happen to meet up with a ballistics detective that worked on my case. And, you know, he told me the one thing that sticks out that from what he told me was he put in a report that based on, I guess, the wildness of the shoot of the bullets, it was either a 90-pound weakling or a woman. God, that's interesting. Again, no internet. What do you do with this? Fast forward to 93, and you know, you alluded to the some of the interviews that Berkowitz did in jail. Well, he did them with Maury Terry. So Maury Terry in 93, he did a series of interviews, and at one point in the interview, he point blank asked David Berkowitz, "Did you shoot Carl DeNiro?" And Berkowitz's reply was no. And he said, "Do you know who did?" And he said, "Yes." And he goes, "Was it a man?" And he said, "No." "Was it a female?" And he said, "Yes." So those three points of interest kind of got me on the conspiracy bandwagon, if you will. And then 2 years or a year after that, I actually met Maury. We did a TV show, a Geraldo TV show together. And we met in a restaurant. The limo picked us up, brought us to the studio. And by the time the show started, Maury and I had become like best of friends. And that friendship remained intact and viable until his untimely death in 2015.
Now he was a reporter on the beat, but he wasn't a crime reporter during the 76-77. He was like a technology reporter, correct?
A tech reporter. Yeah, he worked for IBM and writing technical manuals, and occasionally I think he did some speeches for some of the executives. But he certainly wasn't a true crime reporter. And at the time when Son of Sam started, he wasn't even a newspaper writer.
Wow. So he just found something to sink his teeth in and just went with it.
It was a lot of just to go back to back in like when they caught Berkowitz August 10th, 77, one of the things that everyone said, I mean, it was the talk of the town the next day. All the sketches that the police had put out over the previous 13 months, which I believe were 9 that were released, one of them looked just like Berkowitz. The other 8 looked nothing like Berkowitz. And I'm not talking about hairstyle. I'm talking about facial, facial high cheekbones, chubby face, flat nose, pointed nose, very distinct, and everyone, when they read the paper the next day, were saying, "There's something screwy here. That's not the guy, that the guy they arrested is not the same guy." But everyone kind of, including myself, kind of just said, "Well, the cops must be right, and let's move on." And then, Berkowitz admitted to everything, so that kind of solidified it. But you got to give Maury Terry credit for taking that little piece of evidence. And there was some other things that he didn't think was right, like the timelines didn't match up. And that's what he really started investigating the day that Berkowitz was arrested. Anyone that's involved in Son of Sam research, you might not agree with everything Maury said, but you certainly have to tip your hat to him for delving into it where nobody else even thought to delve into it.
Yeah, documenting it the way he did. And when I was researching it, just it struck me because that's one of the things I'd never heard the alternate theories. But even one of the other victims, Violante, I don't want to destroy his name. Yeah, but he said that he even noticed that the guy who was parked in front of me said he described somebody who did not look even remotely close to Berkowitz. So the eyewitness said it wasn't even close at the time that they wrapped him up. It's just fascinating work, and that makes the book just just amazing to read. And it was interesting. You mentioned that you don't consider yourself a writer. You just being the outspoken person you are, you just had a story that you thought people needed to hear. And it sounds like part of that was to make sure Mr. Terry got what he deserved as far as the recognition for putting that out there and trying to help substantiate him a little bit.
Yeah. It actually, me writing the book actually precedes that. What happened was one of my sisters, who I'm very close with, we're 11 months apart. We've been best friends since we're like 3-4 years old. We were just shooting a breeze one day, and I mentioned something about, well, you know, a woman shot me. And she said, "What are you talking about? You know, David Berkowitz shot you." And I said, "Don't you remember 1993, Berkowitz said on TV that a woman shot me?" And either she didn't see it or she didn't remember. But that was like a red flag went up. And I said, if my own sister doesn't know the story, then, you know, I got to get the word out. The next thing that happened was my daughter was a film student, and she had to do her senior thesis, and she had to make a short film, and she decided to do a short film on me. And so starting that, she interviewed me, she interviewed my sisters, and she interviewed my friends. And I was involved in the whole process. And by the time she had enough information to write a script, I'm like, basically she convinced me I had a story to tell. So those two things started getting me thinking about writing a book. And then the third piece was the Maury Terry piece. And that was my friendship with Maury and how, you know, I met him just going on a TV show with him. I'm forever grateful to Maury for writing The Ultimate Evil, and also for keeping the story alive for so many years. Maury was such an interesting character. And we had, you know, I was friends with him for, I don't know, about 20 years. And there's just so many funny stories and cool stories, funny stories in just hanging out with them, but also some really cool stuff with, working with him. You know, I started out kind of like his apprentice. He didn't have, I had been on the internet since 93, and he didn't even have a computer. So, you know, when I first met him, you know, we're talking about the case, and he's like, "What about this?" And so I said, "You know, a lot of this stuff's on the internet." Now, back then, there wasn't half as much on the internet as there is now, but there was, you know, there was information, like, you know, property records were on the internet. So he started sending me information, like, give me an address. Say, tell me who owned this property for the last 10 years. And things like that. And I really didn't know what I was doing, but I could follow directions. And so I was kind of like a student. And within a couple of years, I felt like I was his peer. You know, I'd come up with these ideas, and we talked on the phone for 2 or 3 hours, 2 or 3 times a week, discussing the case and trying to bring it to closure. And Those are the three main reasons why I felt I needed to write this book.
Well, and you, him just giving you those leads. Think about, I mean, this all went down 77 to 80, and he still got all those little pieces that need to be vetted, and he's still digging through. And just think about, and I would love to know what if he, like, one of those addresses, did one day he calls you, "Hey, can you check this little nugget out for me?" And just was there anything that just kind of blew up? You guys were just tossing ideas around. You throw
there was a few. I remember one address that I came across, and the person that owned the house, or was listed as the owner, was a periphery. And had a periphery involvement in the case. I don't want to say his name because You know, his house was used for some for some drug deals and what have you. But he certainly has, as far as I know, he has nothing to do with the shooting. So, but you know, but little things like that, you know, things would just pop up, and it was like, wow, that's the same person that we were looking at for, you know, for something else. So, you know, I apologize for being so vague about this, but there's one particular address that that really popped out, and that's what I'm talking about. But again, it panned out where it was just you know, apparently Berkowitz was at this house involved in a fairly big drug deal. You know, so,
and just to have that experience of being able to take all that hard, you know, gumshoe work he does, and then 15 years later, putting it together using technology, which led to, you know, you fulfilling out that story. I think that'd be an amazing thing to be a part of.
It was very cool.
Yep. But to get back to, your daughter having the fortitude to do that film project, I can't imagine. I have to imagine that there were some painful times. Was there any experience like that, just with her being willing to face that sort of stuff?
I give her so much credit because I can only imagine. I mean, I went through it and I deal with it. She's got a, you know, obviously we're the same in some ways, but she's not quite as open and, you know, a free spirit as I am. And it had to be tough for her, but like I said, I give her so much credit, and mostly for me, because she's the one that made me realize that I had a story to tell. And on, not really negative, but on the flip side, by doing the interviews that she did, she asked questions of me that were never asked before. And they're kind of personal things, so I don't even want to get into it. But it was kind of like, wow, you know, I never really looked at it that way. Like she was just bringing up personality traits of mine, of how I react to things and how I raised her. And and through the interview process, I realized that my life really has been shaped by what I went through when I was 20 years old.
Yeah. So yeah, very illuminating for a brand new set of eyes, literally new set of eyes, right? Compared to 1976.
Yeah.
Wow. So with Mr. Terry's theory and the work that you guys did together, did you ever confer with the NYPD again or anybody and see and try to compare notes, or was there a willingness to do that?
The short answer is no willingness whatsoever. In fact, I have to say I wasn't involved in the 80s. Like I said, Maury's book came out in 87. I really wasn't involved until I actually met him in 94. But from 94 on, Maury more than me, but I was involved in it too, spent most of our public life defending Maury's theories on multiple shooters. And unfortunately, because I guess it makes good TV and good news, they would always put on an NYPD, you know, usually was Detective Joe Coffey, who has since passed away, and Captain Borelli. They were like the two main spokesmen for the NYPD. And basically it was like, Maury Terry's a kook. Carl Denauer doesn't know what he's talking about. And it got very discouraging because it got to the point where when I got asked to do an interview or a TV show, I would ask who else is on. And if they mentioned Borelli or Coffey, I just said, no, thank you. Because, you know, you sit there and you listen to me and say, okay, I didn't see anything the night of the shooting, but I've spent time researching and I've read Maury Terry's book and here's what I think and so on and so forth. And then Joe Colpe comes on and says, you know, Maury's a kook. You know, Berkowitz is the guy. We got our man, case closed. And now, you know, that now is the end of the show. And the viewers are saying, well, who are you going to believe? The you know, the kid that got shot in the head and didn't see anything, or a seasoned, highly decorated police officer? So, yeah. You know, so we battled that for years. Since then, we've had other, when I say we, I mean the Maury Terry Son of Sam research people who believe in Maury's work. You know, we're constantly defending the theories and Maury's work. And so it's always been an uphill battle.
Yeah. And going against the narrative is, and it's unfortunate there couldn't be just a good back and forth or just a collaborative take a look at what we got. And if there's still a no, at least they took a look, you know?
Well, that you're 100% correct. And one of the problems is, the police reports are hard to come by. Let's leave it at that. Attempts have been made to get police reports. We've gotten very few. Although I have a new tact that I'm hopefully will be successful, and I can get access to the files of the NYPD. I do have just recently. We came across some files from Yonkers Police Department, which there's no smoking gun in those, but at least we are starting to get some files. Yeah.
But when you say you were being mentored by Mr. Terry, he gives you these little tidbits, you chase him down. There might be just a shred in one of those files that's either corroborating or not corroborating. So at least, you know, any little shred could either lead you deeper in or could put a point. Yeah, put a point on
and
something.
I am open, and I've been on record, including in my book. I don't agree with everything Maury said. I agree with his main thesis of multiple shooters. You know, the smaller facts, intricacies, you know, sometimes it's a stretch of imagination. And like I said, I think Maury laid out his main thesis. He laid out with a lot of circumstantial evidence that, you know, you could take it either way. I took it saying, man, this is spot on. It all makes sense. There's some things that Maury said that aren't really backed up with that much evidence or to me good enough evidence. So I'm always open to I don't think anyone's ever going to convince me that Maury Terry was 100% wrong, because you know, I just don't think that's true. But you know, did he make mistakes here and there? Without a doubt. And the guy did spend, approximately nine years of research, and then he started writing his book. And I know from writing my book, it had to take him at least close to a year. And I'm sure he did some research in between. So we're talking 11 years before his book came out. So it wasn't some slipshod thing that he just slapped together.
It was backed up. It was backed up by a lot of hard work.
Right. And to go back to what you said, as far as the tidbits of information, that's very true. And it's exciting, but it also makes this work so difficult, because things that I read 20 years ago meant nothing to me. And then something comes across my desk today, you know, say a name or something, and now all of a sudden what I read 20 years ago makes more sense. And I haven't come up with a system to record all this stuff. I just have, I have stacks of files, and most of it's in my head, to be quite honest with you. You know, somebody will call me up or send me an email saying, hey, did you ever hear of this guy? And I'm like, oh man, that rings a bell. And I go digging through my boxes of, you know, looking for an email or looking for some research that I did 20 years ago. So it makes it difficult, but it's like I said, you know, I guess my main goal is to find out why I was shot, who shot me, and how was I selected? Was it pure randomness? Did they follow me? That's like a burning question for me. I could solve the case or have other people indicted that were involved, that would be just great. But I'm a realist, and I realize 45 years later, if people have gotten away with what they got away with, the chances of me breaking the case is kind of slim to none.
Yeah, but that pursuit's never a bad thing, you know, even in, as long as you're, you know, it's still serving your purpose. That's all that matters. As long as you're still on the search and hopefully you find satisfaction, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, as you said earlier, it hasn't consumed my life. I think I don't even think we'd be having this conversation if I became, you know, like a hermit and quit my job and, you know, lived in a shack down by the river, you know, just, you know, spending all my time obsessing over the Son of Sam.
Yep. And for you to have that instinctual drive when at, you know, 21, 22 years old, to just make that distinction in your life I don't think that's something you can teach. I think that seems to me like it's some innate ability for you to make that step and move on. You know, that's amazing.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, sir, I don't want to keep you all night. I imagine you've got stuff to do. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
I just want to say one. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Not at all. I wanted to make sure you got everything, anything else you wanted to say.
Yeah. I just wanted to let your listeners know that the obviously, you know, we've discussed this, the case is I'm still researching along with a bunch of other people researching the case, and back in November of last year I visited David Berkowitz.
And I had that on my list to ask you about the correspondence. Sorry.
All right. I think it's important. I've sent emails. We've exchanged emails for about 2 years now, and eventually it led to an actual meeting, which was a week before Thanksgiving of last year, and I spent 3.5 hours with David Berkowitz, and let me tell you, it was not as easy as it might sound. It was kind of nerve-wracking, even though I don't believe David Berkowitz shot me. I do believe David Berkowitz was on the site and was part of the group that shot me. It was very unnerving, but I felt it was something I had to do. And he didn't really give me that much information. I did ask him a lot of pointed questions. Who shot me? You know, did you see it? How did you find me? And some of his answers, he wouldn't answer. Some of his answers, he basically lied. And you could tell he was lying because he couldn't look at me. You know, when we talked, we made eye contact. And when I asked him a question that he didn't want to answer, no matter what he said, he would put his head down. And, you know, I mean, basically he told me he just drove around looked for somebody to shoot. And I told him point blank, I said, you're lying. I said that, you know, you shot me or whoever shot me 20 blocks from one of the busiest streets in Queens. You could have drove, you know, 20 blocks away and had the pick of your litter. You could have shot anyone. And instead you found some remote, not remote, but a residential area with no foot traffic and no car traffic. So I said, there's no way you just found me by mistake. So he just hung his head and said, I can't. So Yeah, so hopefully I will be able to meet with him again. Like I said, I think the first meeting went well. We had a few hiccups in between, and I'm in the process of rebuilding a relationship with him. And, you know, who knows? Like, you know, again, we talked about this. Berkowitz is kind of, yeah, it's kind of hard. To take what he says for gospel truth, because he has changed his story several times. He has lied, but I just feel that if he ever is going to tell the truth, I think I'm the guy he's going to tell it to.
Yeah, time, distance, duration gives a maybe gives him a different perspective. And I remember you mentioning the correspondence, and I had it in tiny little scribbles right here. Yeah. And we got talking about so many other great things. It was like, because the correspondence you mentioned, you guys had a meeting set up and then he canceled. And I found a quote of you saying that you didn't think there'd be anything that would come of it. I didn't know you actually got to meet him in person, and that had to take some strength.
Yeah, yeah, it did, and I'm not gonna lie to you, my knees were shaking.
I understand that completely. Well, if anything else ever comes up, you ever want to talk again, hit me up. I'm more than available. I think this has been a great conversation.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
I'll keep you posted on anything new and earth shattering.
I appreciate it, sir. And let me, before we go, what's best for you? Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any place in particular for The Son of Sam and Me?
Yeah, the easiest is Amazon. Amazon, or if anyone, you can give my email address. It's CDX2, the number 2, US at yahoo.com. If you want a signed copy, it's a couple bucks more. It's $20, shipping included.
Thanks, sir. I'll put that in the show notes. Do you have any social platforms, any websites?
No, I just the, there's two Facebook groups that I administer. It's the official Maury Terry Ultimate Evil Facebook group, and believe it or not, the unofficial Maury Terry Ultimate Evil Facebook group. Just a quick explanation.
Sure.
The unofficial started first. It started back in 2008. And the only reason it's unofficial is because it wasn't sanctioned by Maury. And then in 2013, myself and another guy, a friend of Maury's, and Maury decided to do an official page. So it's a lot of the same material, a lot of the same members, but the official group is a little bit more closed, because we've just had a lot of, what do you call those people? Trolls and sock puppets.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of information in the official group, in our archives, that is good, including some of the few police reports that we've been able to get. And I just basically, I don't want to give it out to any nut weirdo or wingding.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them out there.
Yeah. It provides a lot of room for great communication and collaboration, but it's also got to have a filter.
Yeah,
or else you start getting people that are a little bit outside the fringe.
Right. Exactly.
Yep. Well, thank you, sir. And just to remind everybody, my audiobook Blood Red Ivory comes out May 3rd, which should be tomorrow. So I can't wait to hear what you think of that, and see you next time.
All right, take care.